You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hey, gang. We're going to hear from Professor George Nash, episode 133 of your Rock Art Podcast, this time from the UK. And George has had a flamboyant career, globe-trotting all over the stratosphere and finding remarkable archaeology and rock art. You will love him. What a joy to behold. Well, hello, boys and girls. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm here in primitive Bakersfield, California, talking to Dr. George Nash from the UK. Can you imagine? I don't think we've ever had anyone in the 3 years that I've been podcasting on this rock art podcast from the UK. So this is a first, George. We're honored and blessed to have you as a guest scholar.
Well, as they say in Welsh, shumai heddiw, da iawn. So yes, I'm very, very privileged and honored to be here with you, Alan.
And this is the only rock art podcast in the world, to my knowledge.
As far as I'm aware, yes. There are podcasts I deal with, which are basically anthropology and archaeology, but nothing specific on rock art. But I can talk rock art until the cows come home.
That's great. So the way I opened this up, you know, originally is, you could certainly give a bit of background about your identification currently, but also how the heck did you ever get into this crazy profession of anthropology, archaeology, and the study of the past, which quite unusual.
Well, it's a bit of an interesting story. I mean, I will say that I'm very, very rich in terms of the intellectual bank, but financially poor, because all archaeologists and anthropologists are poor. And really, my story starts way back, and it's quite an interesting story, and I think it applies to a lot of people. But back in the 1980s, the early 1980s, I was trained as a commercial artist, and I did a degree in art, fine art and graphics and photography, and got a job. But at the time, in the early 1980s, the UK, and I dare say the US as well, was going through a revolution in terms of what they call new technology. And so everything that I did was done by hand and a keen eye. But we had this thing called digitization. So everything was going digital. So I worked with analog. They wanted to go digital. And all the companies I worked for were going out of business because at the time, there were very strong union representations to say that we should stay as we are, stay traditional. And that wasn't going to be the case. And so around about 1982, 83, I got fed up with going from one art studio to another. And I just then turned to my then wife and said, do you fancy an adventure? And she said, yes, of course. So I went to do a degree in, first of all, in archaeology and ancient history at the University College St David's in Lampeter in Wales, which incidentally is the third oldest university in England and Wales, and I hated every minute of it. So in my second year, I had a chance of moving across to doing archaeology and environmental sciences, which I did and thoroughly enjoyed. At the same time, whilst I was doing the last 2 years of my degree, I met a couple of people who were really very inspiring with what they taught me. One was a guy called Professor Mike Walker, who was a specialist in quaternary science. So that scientific background, that baseline that I needed to carry me through to understand things like rock art, for example, and understand chronology, but in a natural sciences approach, he gave me that information. And then I met up with a guy called Professor Chris Tilley. And Chris Tilley has just died, in fact. He died in March. But he was really one of the most important people at the time to bring in what we call social theory in archaeology. So if any of you or anybody out there listening to this and remembers Shanks and Tilley, Mike Shanks and Chris Tilley, and Mike Shanks is actually at Stanford, they were big influences on certainly the way I sort of took my philosophy forward.
What is social theory or social archaeology?
Social theory is basically looking at the idea of how philosophy can answer some of the questions in archaeology. Now, just remember that when you or I dig an archaeological site, we are maybe only looking at, if we're looking at a prehistoric site, only looking at maybe 5% of the total material culture. If we sit in our offices now, we have an explanation for every bit of material culture, right down to the printer, to the computer, to the table, to the chairs we're sitting on. Whereas if we're looking at an archaeological site, say 50,000 years ago, we don't have those explanations. We can't work out what the critical theory or the meaning of objects, because those objects have obviously decayed, or they've been lost, they've been destroyed. And so we have to try and work out what we can say about the other 95% that's missing from the archaeological record. So theory comes into play a lot, certainly in my world. So I was taught things like phenomenology, semiotics, hermeneutics, and these are all sort of French philosophical discourses that came through and sort of creeped into the archaeological sort of studying in British universities and certainly American universities as well back in the 1980s.
I think the UK is, and what you're talking about, for some reason, seems to be far more advanced in some ways than my colleagues in the Americas.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that the American university system was really based on anthropology, and anthropology provides some of the answers, but obviously, as we well know, that anthropology can sometimes be a little bit dangerous, and so you have to think about other things that can come into the record, be it the archaeological record or whatever, or the record of the past, I think is a better term to use.
And they really, since this is partly a story about rock art or, the element of semiotics. Mm. I just finished a book, 70,000 word book, on the iconicity of the Uto-Aztecans, basically a semiotic study. Now, just saying that, rock art studies is still, I'd say, one of the ugly stepchildren of archaeology here in the States, because I don't think they truly grasp the powerful database, the powerful data set that rock art is or has or means or could potentially be informative on such a great variety of topics, and also the intimate association it has with meaning from an emic standpoint.
I think you're right. And I mean, the thing that I've already said is that we are missing, 95% plus of the meaning and understanding, not just of the archaeology, but also of rock art as well. I mean, if you look at the stuff you see in California, for example, or I did some work in Oregon many, many years ago, and beautiful paintings, beautiful engravings are on these rocks, but we still don't know the full meaning of them. And I mean, it keeps me in a job, but it keeps you in a job as well, Alan, I dare say.
Absolutely.
Because you can set out a number of theories, a number of ideas about that meaning, but it's trying to establish what is going on. And one thing I like to do with my students, I don't talk in years or thousands of years, I talk in generations of community. So for example, if we think about if we look at a typical century, 100 years, there's probably three or four generations of community or three or four generations of family. You times that by 10 to get 1,000 years, you've got yourself 30, 40 generations of community and so on and so forth. And the big problem we have at the moment is that when people were making art, if you want to call it art or some form of visual communication system, as I prefer to call it, say 20,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago, the meaning of that art or that insignia is slowly but surely being lost generation after generation after generation until we get to 2024 when we haven't a clue what it means. And this is where the philosophy comes into being quite an important tool to use when trying to work out the interpretation of some rock art.
And sometimes the subject can be studied in a broad way using the terminology, forager theology.
Yes. Yeah, by all means, yes. Yeah. I mean, people use the word ritual or the words ritual and symbolism quite loosely. And I think sometimes you've got to break that down if you can. And I think what I quite like, I mean, I was saying to Chris earlier on that one of the most interesting things that I've been looking at is looking at modern graffiti.
Yes.
And that's really one of my sort of specialisms. I had the pleasure of doing some programs for the BBC a few years ago on modern graffiti, looking in particular at Banksy, work of the graffiti artist Banksy.
Sure.
And what was really interesting there is looking at the underlying meanings of contemporary art and just seeing where we can go with this when we're looking at prehistoric art. So the one thing I was interested in, for example, was the idea of gender, looking at disenchanted youth, looking at how they express themselves because they're disenchanted, because they haven't got jobs, they haven't got no money, and how they express that meaning onto a wall. And if you can look at those sort of things, and also territoriality as well, how gangs, for example, do tagging within our cities and towns around the US and the UK, and how they organise themselves around territories, we can start to work out, for example, the distribution of rock art in prehistoric times, maybe for different reasons, maybe for more religious, symbolic and ritual reasons, but it's a start with trying to unravel, and I think it's a good word.
Right, and there are analogues going on there. There is definitely a structure of meaning, the meaning of meaning, semiotics, but also looking at this imagery.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
From my work and yours.
Yeah.
There are times, there are cultures, there are circumstances where we get to peer into the past because of the preservation or the consistent, 2,000 years of continuous activity where the theology is maintained and preserved.
Yes, and also I think it's an important point to consider, Alan, as well. You start to also see sort of changes. I mean, the one thing you can do, certainly within a European context, and I don't like using the European context too much, but you can see these sort of waves of style coming through.
Yes. Yes.
And they're synchronous right through the European continent. They even spread even further east into Eurasia as well, where you have, for example, Magdalenian is a good example, the Magdalenian period, which is, the latter part of the Upper Paleolithic. You've got figurative animals being beautifully painted, and then it stops suddenly. You then go to sort of more geometric forms, and then you go back then in the Mesolithic, you are going towards portable art, and then in the Neolithic, you're heading towards more geometric and abstract forms, and then in the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, you get figurative stuff, and it's occurs all the way through. But again, it's synchronous all the way through. And again, if you wanted to take it even further than that, I mean, I've done work in South America and obviously work in South Africa as well. And the similar sort of thing is going on. These patterns seem to be re-emerging all the time in waves. I would call it chronological waves throughout prehistory.
I like that. I like that terminology. I've never heard it before, but I like it. I like that particular way of describing the chronological waves. We see that in COSO rock art.
Yes.
And I had never discovered that before. And it's only been recently that we can explicate some of the earlier archaic elements that to me potentially may be pre-shamanic. In sort of the existence of this cultic phenomenon, this mother of game, or this animal mistress, or this lunar goddess phenomenon, that may have occurred early, and then it's basically gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's the further you go back, obviously, the more problematic the material culture is to try and understand. I mean, I've talked about the magic 5% or 95% missing from these total material culture.
Yes.
But if we go back to that time, and there's an interesting time area that I'm looking at the moment between 40,000 and 50,000, this where we start to see in Europe Neanderthals are dominant at 50,000, they are there at 40,000, but suddenly they start to sort of deplete and go away.
Yeah.
But with it, you know, they're taking away their material culture. And part of that material culture, I'm sure, is rock art. And the question I'm asking a lot of my colleagues is, are we teaching Neanderthals how to do art, or are they teaching us? And again, and that's an important point, because again,
it is.
If you look at the legacy that Neanderthals have had, or the bad press they've had, certainly with British archaeologists over the last 120, 150 odd years, these are brutish animals,
right.
but clearly now we're starting to see that is not the case. You know, they believed in abstract thought, they were burying the dead in a particular way, and also I would argue, we've now got proof of this, and I will talk to you a little bit about this a little bit later on, but we've certainly got evidence, certainly within two or three caves, where we've picked up the DNA of Neanderthals producing rock art. So,
okay.
And this is in Europe. So it's a really interesting sort of, I think we're on a very interesting sort of cusp.
We are. Yeah. Every day there's revolutions in this particular discipline of ours.
Yeah.
And I think this is a great place to stop, a segue, and move to our next segment.
Yeah, sure.
See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. We've got Professor George Nash, who is from the UK, and he's online. And we're going to talk about his active research areas and learn more about his discoveries and his wonderful nature in terms of his perspective on the study of anthropology, archaeology, and rock art. God bless you, George. It's all yours. Go ahead.
Well, actually, I think I need to sort of go back quite a few years, in fact, Alan. I think what is quite important is that, as I said to you before, one of my biggest influences was a guy called Chris Tilley, professor at UCL. And I started he was instrumental in me doing my master's, and I did my master's on portable art from the Danish and South Scandinavian Mesolithic. So basically, I was looking at decorated bone, antler, and amber. And these are sort of portable items that will be carried around a landscape around Southern Scandinavia and also in the UK as well. And they would have geometric forms on them. Sometimes they would be figurative. There'd be red deer carved on these little pieces of bone and antler. Sometimes the amber was shaped into animals, and they would be drilled with drill holes, so you'd be wearing them as pendants. And so this is where I really, in many respects, this is where I expanded my sort of interest into archaeology and anthropology, because what I wanted to think about was the idea about how these things move around. How do ideas move around a landscape, or in this case, an islandscape? And so I did a lot of work on this for 1 year. And then I think I did a good job because I was then asked to publish a book on it, and I did. So that was really the start of my sort of academic career in many respects, as well as a few papers. And then I was still in contact with Chris Tilley, and he said, well, what are you going to do now then, George? And I said, no idea, Chris. He said, rock art. And that was it. And so I shifted then from the University of Wales to NTNU in Trondheim in Norway. I did my PhD in Norway, and my PhD was on rock engravings from the Norwegian coastlines, the fjords of central Norway. Uh-huh. And I did a comparative analysis with that lot with Spanish Levantine rock art. Wow. Which was painted. Now, forget the medium, forget they were carvings and paintings. What I wanted to do was look at the underlying mechanisms that make people want to do art onto rock, and in particular hunter fisher gatherers. So I looked at all manner of things. I looked at a lot of anthropological and ethnographic examples, both from the US, especially in northern US and also Canada as well. Mm-hmm. And I did a comparative analysis, and that was finished 35 years ago or something like that. Wow. And really, that set me on course, really. I mean, I had a choice. So I had a choice at the time when I finished my PhD was to, shall I forget rock art and go and do sort of excavation, which I do still do excavation, or do I pursue rock art as an academic pursuit? And that's what I've been doing for the last 40-odd years. And I've gone from really looking at things like, as I've sort of mentioned already, modern graffiti, contemporary art. But really I specialised, or I have been specialising in geometric forms from Neolithic burial monuments, especially in Western Europe, Atlantic Europe. And I'm now at the moment, and again, this is a story you just couldn't make up, but I left my job in 2021. I think I was bullied, but it wasn't an academic position. It was a commercial position I had. And on November the 1st, and then on November the 6th, I got an invite to go to work in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. And I said yes straight away. And the best thing I ever did, because I got absolute freedom to do what I really wanted to do, which was basically to do more cave work, looking at paintings in particular. And the reason why I say paintings rather than engravings was that we have a revolution going on, a technical revolution going on in Europe at the moment, whereby we can now start to understand how pigments are produced. We can also see pigments that we couldn't see before, and I'll come to that in a minute. And so really, in many respects, my sort of philosophical background has slowly but surely been turning into something a lot more hard science. And so a lot of my colleagues were working with a thing called decorrelation stretch, right, which is a color algorithm, which I dare say you've got in the US. And it was actually invented in the US by a guy called John Hartson in 1995. Yeah. And it's an absolute godsend for people like me who've got poor eyesight anyway. But the one thing it does give us, it allows us to look at panels in caves in particular, where there's been very little sort of problems with erosion or weathering. And you can tease out even the most minutest fractions of pigment on cave walls. And that has been a big revolution, certainly within our field. In the UK, it's hardly used, but where I teach in Portugal and Spain, it's used a lot. And so I've now teamed up with colleagues of mine, actually colleagues who I was supervisor to and examined their PhDs. We've got a team called First Art, and there's five or six of us from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Wales, not England.
Wow.
And we go around the world, and so we've been doing a lot of work all over the place, and I'll be also working with somebody from Canada as well. Mm-hmm. And so we've been working in Jordan, Israel, before this trouble started.
Yeah.
I've been working in South Africa, Spain, Portugal, and also we have it in my native Wales. Now, the wonderful thing about Wales is that I call Wales a northern frontier, and what I mean by northern frontier is that the glaciers, the last glacial maximum, which occurs between say 15,000 and 40,000 years ago, came down from Scandinavia across the North Sea into the British Isles, but stopped, thank goodness, just a few kilometres north of the current South Wales coastline. And within that coastline, it's a limestone area, so there's lots of caves in there. And all the caves that I visited 30 or 40 years ago without looking for rock art, I'm now looking for rock art, and I've now got seven caves now under my belt which have yielded prehistoric art. Two of those caves I've now successfully dated to the Paleolithic. So I'm very, very, very happy about that. It's telling me that in these harsh climbs during the glacial maximum, and I'll give you some idea of how cold it was. It was around about minus 10 in the summer. So it was very much a Siberian winter, but in the summer. And we as modern humans, we were following migratory herds of mammoth, horse, bison, elk, and reindeer, and later on a red deer as well. And we were butchering them, and we were creating these utilization sites where we were extracting marrow, making bone tools, eating the flesh. But luckily, it was all around the cave sites around South Wales, because we're picking up all this bone evidence in these bone caves. And a lovely story, I was taking students to a site called Cathole Cave. And again, I can probably go into more detail a little bit later on about this one, but I found rock art in there and got a date of, I think, around about 14,505 BP before present. And that was a stalagmite flow or calcite flow over an engraved reindeer carving. And so I had a minimum date of 14,505 plus or minus a couple hundred years either side. So it was then the oldest rock art we had dated, a minimum date, in the whole of northwestern Europe at that time. Obviously, I've now pushed those boundaries further back because I've been looking at another site which has yielded an even much, much earlier date. So some really exciting things going on at the moment and have been with me for the last 30-odd years. And it started off really with looking at Neolithic chambered tombs and looking at the idea about how agrarian societies were utilising landscapes and utilising, in particular, ritual landscapes. And that's culminated in several books. And there's one book which is just about to be published, in fact, called The Chambered Tombs of Wales. And it'll be published in about 2 weeks' time. So it's you don't know my age, but I'm over a certain age, but I wish I was 30 years younger to enjoy and do more digging and more excavation and more prospection of these sites. The wonderful thing about the book I've just done is that I've also brought in rock art as well, because you may not know, but in northwestern Europe and Atlantic Europe, there are many thousands of Neolithic chambered tombs. And of those thousands of chambered tombs, there's about 10 to 15% of those monuments that at some point in their life are either painted on or carved upon. And so in Portugal, for example, or in Spain, there's a lot of a painting and engraving within the same monument. However, as you will imagine, we always joke about this in Britain, the British weather unfortunately has denuded and decayed any potential painting. However, this is the beauty of it, there's a lot of engraved rock art, about, again, between 10 and 15% of all chambered tombs in Wales, for example, and there are about 250 extant monuments. So there's about 20 to 30 monuments within the megalithic record in Wales that have either simple cup marks on them or grooves or cup and ring marks. And in some cases, you get this what we call megalithic art, where you get chevrons, spirals, concentric circles being put into the chambers of these monuments. These are passage graves. And again, for those people who are listening to this who don't know what a passage grave is, it's basically a circular monument which has, guess what, a passage which leads to a chamber. And within that chamber, you may have side chambers, and those side chambers are being decorated. So we have that. Now, what I've managed to prove is that one particular stone, there's only one stone in the whole of Wales, which I've looked at, which is a stone called C16. It hasn't even got a name. And it's at a site called Barclodydd y Gawas in an island called Anglesey, or if you're Welsh, Ynys Mon. And this is a passage grave. It dates to around about 3000 BC, so 5,000 years old. And up until it was excavated in the 1950s, it was the whole of the chamber was buried with accumulated soils, which had accumulated since its demise as a passage grave monument, maybe around about 2000 BC. So between 2000 BC and 1952, in fact, when they started excavating, there was a really good stratigraphic deposition of natural deposits in the chamber. These were excavated and revealed. From that excavation were five stones which had been excavated, including C16. When I did de-stretch on the stone for a laugh, I found minute fragments of red hematite pigment inside some of the pecked areas of the stones. It wasn't just engraved with pecked designs of chevrons and a spiral and zigzag lines, but it was also painted as well. And I think this is the first painted site that we have from the Neolithic in this part of Europe. So, yeah, very exciting. It's just by chance. I would say in many respects, if you were to say to me, "Oi, Nash, do you think you've been lucky?" I will say, hell yes. I'm really, really lucky. It's just being in the right place at the right time, and also maybe having that sort of open mind with philosophy, hard science, and the approaches to approach a site in that particular way. And also I've been helped really with a lot of very, very good colleagues of mine. We set up a thing called the Welsh Rock Art Organisation back in 2004. And basically what we had to do was basically look for rock art, because again, an interesting point is that in 1999, when there was a book published by a guy called Stan Beckinsale, and he reported, I think, around about 15 sites in Wales, about 4,000 or 5,000 in Scotland and in Northern Britain, but only 15 in Wales. Wow. And so it was our job from 2004 onwards to increase that number. We've now got about 170 sites from just by prospecting, people getting in contact with me on Facebook and social media saying, "Dear Dr. Nash, we have a site here which has, we think, cut marks on it. Is it or isn't it?" And so I'll go and visit that site at some point and then verify whether it's not, it's rock art or not. So, for example, last week, somebody get in contact with me. They were about to give a talk at a local archaeology society. They said, "I've got a rock here with some cut marks on it. Is it or isn't it?" And they just showed me the photographs, and I instantly knew it was rock art. It was probably Bronze Age in date, so between, say, 900 BC to around about 2200, 2500 BC. So, you know, you instantly pick up the stylistic engravings on these portable rocks and also on sites, and I can instantly tell you where they come from and where the influences come from as well. So,
Dr. Nash, you're just a joy, and your enthusiasm and your knowledge is so engaging and so so deep and so wide and so powerful.
I look forward to sharing a beef burger with you at some point, Alan.
Yeah, but we have to close out this segment and go to the next. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Well, gang, we're here for the final segment. It's your episode 133 with Dr. Nash from the UK. And he is just a joy and just a bundle of energy. Take it away, Dr. Nash.
Right, well, the final segment was a difficult one to think about, really, because without being too big-headed, I've done a hell of a lot. And so I was thinking about, I mean, I've done stuff in Mount Carmel in Israel, and that's probably one of the most wonderful experiences I've had in terms of looking at cave art and finding it and discovering it. I've also worked in Chile and Brazil. I'm going to stick with my native Wales. There was a site I've just done recently. It was on my sort of radar for quite a few years. Again, going back to Christopher Tilley, who was my sort of big influencer in many respects at university as an undergraduate. He persuaded me to do an undergraduate dissertation on looking at the architecture of megaliths, megalithic chamber tombs. And I thoroughly enjoyed that. And I've always kept that in the back of my head, even when I've been sort of looking at rock art. And so when we set up the Royal Welsh Rock Art Organisation in 2004, we started to think about looking at megalithic sites which have an element of rock art incorporated into them. And again, for people listening, if you don't know what I'm talking about, I'm talking about sites which are made of stone and they form a burial monument where you bury the dead. It could be a single burial if it's a portal dolmen, or if it's a passage grave, it could be multiple burials within that monument. And basically, whatever monument you're looking at made of stone and it's a burial monument, it has five components. It has a passage, an entrance, a facade, a mound, and it has a chambered area where the burials will go. Incorporated either inside or outside is sometimes rock art. We're not quite sure if rock art was actually applied to the monument whilst it was being constructed, or was it a fad, a sort of hip and trendy thing to do at around about 3000 BC, and they start to incorporate on some but not all. And as I said to you before, it's usually between 10 and 15% across Atlantic Europe where we're seeing monuments are being decorated. And there are also a lot of monuments which are not decorated. Although, again, as I said to you before, we have a big problem with weathering, certainly as you go towards the British Isles, where it's quite substantial weathering on rock, and therefore anything which was painted will have disappeared a long time ago.
Sure.
In 2004, we started to look at a number of monuments. So we did over a 20-year period from 2004 to 2024. We looked at about five different excavations, all in Wales, and all of these monuments had rock art, an element of rock art within them. However, the one which was really, I think, the most interesting for me was a site called Trelyfiant. And Trelyfiant is a Welsh chambered tomb. It's a dolmen site. And it is located within a county called Pembrokeshire, which is in southwest Wales. And the site is near a small fishing village called Newport. And it's part of a number of monuments, maybe I think about nine monuments, that encircle a river valley called the Nevern Valley. And it's what is quite clearly going on here is that megalithic builders, people building these monuments, are fascinated by putting their sights on the areas of landscape which overlook this particular river valley. It happens elsewhere within Wales, but this is a particular sort of trait that we're seeing with these particular monuments. And quite interestingly, of those nine sites, there's about four of them which have rock art on them. And the rock art is very simple. It's usually cut marks on the top of a capstone. And in prehistory, when these monuments were being utilised by Neolithic farmers, they would have created a mound around the chamber, but the chamber capstone would have been exposed to the weathering. And so what is quite interesting is that the site of Trelyfiant, which I excavated I investigated it between 2014 and 2019, and I published the results in 2021-2022. And what was really interesting about that was, as we had found with other sites, is that we have not just the site itself, but there are also other things going on within the landscape. What the Welsh Rock Art Organisation comprised of were obviously myself, there were two archaeologists, Carol James and Tom Wellicombe, very, very good archaeologists, and we had two geophysicists who did the geophysics and also looked at the LIDAR surveys as well. And what was really interesting is that this site and a site nearby which we excavated, a site called Trefail, it had an amazing buried landscape. And that landscape had been buried, but all the features, that all the lumps and bumps that you would see from a normal archaeological site had been buried by a deposit called loess. And this loess is a very, very fine sediment, which is brought in by the westerly winds, picking up these very, very fine sediments from beach sediments and then depositing them on the land. And that slowly gets built up over 3,000 or 4,000 years. So it wasn't just the monument itself that was of interest, but it was also the landscape around it, because the geophysics told us that we were dealing with two henges. So think about Stonehenge, but without the stones. So two henges, a series of trackways, a series of later Bronze Age barrows. And so it was just a very, very busy landscape. So we first of all looked at the stone itself, and what was interesting was that nobody had ever recorded the cut marks on top of the capstone. There had been sort of attempts to produce a stylistic record, but nothing in any accuracy at all. And so what we did was we did some, what we call a bleak lighted photography. So we used side lights in the middle of in darkness hours, used an oblique light, and then we photographed from above, and we got some absolutely fantastic imagery of this capstone. And quite clearly, although I'm going to get lambasted for saying this, but I think that the cup marks represent star constellations.
Oh my word, wow.
Well, this is a trait we're seeing right through Western British Isles, where we see cup marks being placed on top of capstones. So, for example, we counted 75 cup marks from this stone. Nearby Trofeo, which I excavated in 2012 with the Welsh Rock Art Organisation, we had around about 80 to 90 cup marks. My colleagues, the geophysicists, and I have just done work at a site called Garreg Fawr in North Wales, which is a Neolithic axe factory, plus chambered monuments, plus stone circles. And we've got about 148 cut marks on there. So it just gives you an idea about what is going on. And if you look hard enough, I mean, I've tried to use an astronomer to say, well, can you see anything in terms of star constellations there? He said, no, it's just a mass of cut marks. So I somehow think, and again, this is my theoretical head coming out now, I think these are replicating star constellations. And this idea about going either to the underworld or the overworld is occurring within the Neolithic ritualized society.
Fabulous. Absolutely fabulous.
Yeah. So we got that. So we did the recording on that, and then we did the geophysical survey around the monument. We did four segments of 20 square meters, so 80 odd meters in total. And mm-hmm. we come across these two henge sites. And so we decided to do two small excavations. And they were speculative excavations, although targeted, but we knew we were excavating over the henges, but we didn't know what we were going to find. And so we started digging, and we noticed that the stratigraphy was running around about, and our work in American feet and inches, we went about a foot below the ground level, 30 centimetres, and we came across two fantastic pits which contained about 30 or 40 pieces of pottery from one pot. Now, just bear in mind that the soil within this part of the British Isles is very, very acidic, and usually pottery, human remain or bones, animal bone, human bones, teeth, do not survive the archaeological record. But for some reason, this pottery had. And it's more than likely that it was probably a pot which was put into something like a leather receptacle, and mm-hmm. that allowed some form of preservation of this pottery. Now, what we were really fortunate about, when I picked up the first piece of pottery from that pit, I said to my team, for goodness sake, don't clean it, don't wash it, just give it to me and it'll be excavated in the laboratory. So we excavated the pottery in the laboratory because we managed to take off the residues from inside the pot. So if any of you got a dirty saucepan in your kitchen, which you haven't cleaned for a long time, don't, because it has food residues on it, and you can date the food residues. And we did this. We used a new dating system, which was dating the lipids from the food residues on the inside of the pottery. And we got a date of 3,100 BC. So that tells us that the henges and the monument. The monument was probably a lot earlier, in fact. Probably the actual stone monument, the extant stone monument with the cut marks on top of the capstone, were probably about 3,500 BC, but these were around about 3,100 BC. So it tells me that we're looking at a dynamic landscape. So we've got something which is kicking off in the early Neolithic at 3,500, 3,600, with an extant monument, a portal dolmen called Trelifiant. And then later on, we've got henges, barrows, cairns, all manner of later prehistoric monuments forming around it. So they're probably using that extant monument as a focus for further ritual activity. Now, to make it even more interesting is that we found also from our excavation two shale beads which were perforated. And again, I would classify that as art with a small A. Mm-hmm. And they come from, that we know where these artifacts came from, because about 25 kilometers to the south of the site is a site called Nab Head. And Nab Head is a little sort of jut which goes into Cardigan Bay, into the southern part of the Cardigan Bay, and it's a Mesolithic site. So we now know it's not just Neolithic and Bronze Age we've got there, we've also got evidence of probable Mesolithic occupation or activity around Trelifiant. So, you know, a really interesting sort of history, which was probably spanning around about 6,000 to 7,000 years. So that is probably one of the most important sites I've had to look at in terms of rock art, with my interest in rock art and the Neolithic, and also the landscape as well, because the landscape is, again, paramount with understanding why people build monuments where they do. And also the most important thing, which I've missed out really in many respects, is that there's a blueprint running right through the Neolithic in Western Britain, whereby at one point we're constructing portal dolmens, which are the earliest burial monuments we have in Western Britain. And these date, as I said to you before, between 3,500 and 3,800. But they also get used all the way through the Neolithic, right through to that transition between the Neolithic and Bronze Age, and maybe even going into the Bronze Age as well.
Fabulous.
But as I said to you before, this particular group of monuments around the Nevern Valley, including Trelifiant, has, in my view, some of the most wonderful rock art incorporated into the architecture of each of these monuments.
So, Dr. Nash, if you were to put a bow on it and give a takeaway to our listenership about what it is to do what you're doing and what relevancy that has for them and for the cosmos at large, what would you say?
One thing I would say, Alan, is that it's easy to read a lot of really good primary sources for these sites. But the one thing you need to do, and I urge any listener in particular, where you're based in the US, if you're looking at rock art, is go and look at the site yourself and look at it again, because you can put 100 anthropologists in one room and there'll be 100 answers to one site. And what you've got to think about is that every interpretation of that site is as valid as any professor would have an interpretation of that site. So I think it's really important that people go and visit these places and make up their own minds about what might be going on. Some of the interpretations may be wacky, but some also may be very, very valid as well. I mean, I've had students throughout my career who have come up with ideas, and a lot of them make sense. And the one thing we don't know, the full answer, even to looking at stuff which is from the Iron Age, the Bronze Age, or the Neolithic in Europe. And also I would argue, if you're looking at some of the rock art you have in California, for example, or in Oregon, I did some work in Oregon. And again, unless you understand the myths and the legends of Native American Indians, for example, I don't feel that's the right term to use.
Yeah.
It's only they will know the answers to some of these questions, but even they are stuck in some respects in understanding their ancestry and the art that was produced, say, even just 200, 300 years before white settlers came into those parts of the United States.
Superb. Thank you, Dr. Nash. God bless you. And we're signing off, and This has been quite the adventure, the geographical and philosophical tour of the UK and all throughout the world. God bless everybody. See you in the flip-flop.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.